Stein advocated crazy stuff. If you weren't getting through to a patient, get crazy. Dress up in a clown suit, kick the patient, squirt him with a water pistol, do any damn thing that came into your head, but do something. Look, he used to say, what you're doing now isn't working, so you might as well do something else, no matter how crazy it seems. That was fine back then, Norman thought. He'd like to see Stein assess this problem. What would Dr. Stein tell him to do? Open the door. I can't, she's locked it. Talk to her. I can't, she won't listen. Turn on your air. I can't, she has control of the system. Get control of the system. I can't, she is in control. Find help inside the room. I can't, there is nothing left to help me. Then leave. I can't, I... He paused. That wasn't true. He could leave by smashing a porthole, or for that matter, by opening the hatch in the ceiling. But there was no place to go. He didn't have a suit. The water was freezing. He had been exposed to that freezing water for only a few seconds, and he had nearly died. If he were to leave the room for the open ocean, he would almost surely die. He'd probably be fatally chilled before the chamber even filled with water. He would surely die. In his mind, he saw Stein raise his bushy eyebrows, give his quizzical smile. So, you'll die anyway. What have you got to lose? A plan began to form in Norman's mind. If he opened the ceiling hatch, he could go outside the habitat. Once outside, perhaps he could make his way down to A-Sill, get back in through the airlock, and put his suit on. Then he would be okay. If he could make it to the airlock. How long would that take? 30 seconds? A minute? Could he hold his breath that long? Could he withstand the cold that long? You'll die anyway. And then he thought, you damn fool, you're holding an oxygen bottle in your hand. You have enough air if you don't stay here wasting time worrying. Get on with it. No, he thought, there's something else, something I'm forgetting. Get on with it. So he stopped thinking and climbed up to the ceiling hatch at the top of the cylinder. Then he held his breath, braced himself, and spun the wheel, opening the hatch. Norman! Norman, what are you doing? Norman! You are insane! He heard Beth shout, and then the rest was lost in the roar of freezing water pouring like a mighty waterfall into the habitat, filling the room. The moment he was outside, he realized his mistake. He needed weights. His body was buoyant, tugging him up toward the surface. He sucked a final breath, dropped the oxygen bottle, and desperately gripped the cold pipes on the outside of the habitat, knowing that if he lost his grip, there would be nothing to stop him. Nothing to grab onto all the way to the surface. He would reach the surface and explode like a balloon. Holding the pipes, he pulled himself down, hand over hand, looking for the next pipe, the next protrusion to grab. It was like mountain climbing in reverse. If he let go, he would fall upward and die. His hands were long since numb. His body was stiff with cold, slow with cold. His lungs burned. He had very little time. He reached the bottom, swung under D-sill, pulled himself along, felt in the darkness for the airlock. It wasn't there. The airlock was gone. Then he saw he was beneath B-sill. He moved over to A, felt the airlock. The airlock was closed. He tugged the wheel. It was shut tight. He pulled on it, but he could not move it. He was locked out. The most intense fear gripped him. His body was almost immobile from cold. He knew he had only a few seconds of consciousness remaining. He had to open the hatch. He pounded it, pounded the metal around the rim, feeling nothing in his numb hands. The wheel began to spin by itself. The hatch popped open. There must have been an emergency button. He burst above the surface of the water, gasped air, and sank again. He came back up, but he couldn't climb out into the cylinder. He was too numb, his muscles frozen, his body unresponsive. You have to do it, he thought. You have to do it. His fingers gripped metal, slipped off, gripped again. One pull, he thought. One last pull. He heaved his chest over the metal rim, flopped onto the deck. He couldn't feel anything, he was so cold. He twisted his body, trying to pull his legs up, and fell back into the icy water. No! He pulled himself up again, one last time, again over the rim, again onto the deck, and he twisted one leg up, his balance precarious. Then the other leg, he couldn't really feel it. and then he was out of the water and lying on the deck. He was shivering. He tried to stand and fell over. His whole body was shaking so hard he could not keep his balance. Across the airlock, he saw his suit hanging on the wall of the cylinder. He saw the helmet, Johnson, stenciled on it. Norman crawled toward the suit, his body shaking violently. He tried to stand and could not. The boots of his suit were directly in front of his face. He tried to grip them in his hands, but his hands could not close. He tried to bite the suit, to pull himself up with his teeth, but his teeth were chattering uncontrollably. The intercom crackled. "Norman! I know what you're doing, Norman!" Any minute Beth would be here. He had to get into the suit. He stared at it inches from him, but his hands still shook. He could not hold anything. Finally, he saw the fabric loops near the waist to clip instruments. He hooked one hand into the loop, managed to hold on. He pulled himself upright. He got one foot into the suit, then the other. "Norman!" He reached for the helmet. The helmet drummed in a staccato beat against the wall before he managed to get it free of the peg and drop it over his head. He twisted it, heard the click of the snap lock. He was still very cold. Why wasn't the suit heating up? Then he realized, no power. The power was in the tank pack. Norman backed up against the tank, shrugged it on, staggered under the weight. He had to hook the umbilicus. He reached behind him, felt it, held it, hook it into the suit, at the waist, hook it. He heard a click. The fan hummed. He felt long streaks of pain all over his body. The electrical elements were heating, painful against his frozen skin. He felt pins and needles all over. Beth was talking. He heard her through the intercom, but he couldn't listen to her. He sat heavily on the deck, breathing hard. But already he knew that he was going to be all right. The pain was lessening, his head was clearing, and he was no longer shaking so badly. He had been chilled, but not long enough for it to be central. He was recovering fast. The radio crackled. "You'll never get to me, Norman." He got to his feet, pulled on his weight belt, locked the buckles. "Norman!" He said nothing. He felt quite warm now, quite normal. "Norman, I am surrounded by explosives. If you come anywhere near me, I will blow you to pieces. You'll die, Norman. You'll never get near me." But Norman wasn't going to Beth. He had another plan entirely. He heard his tank air hiss as the pressure equalized in his suit. He jumped back into the water. 0500 hours. The sphere gleamed in the light. Norman saw himself reflected in its perfectly polished surface, then saw his image break up, fragmented on the convolutions, as he moved around to the back, to the door. It looked like a mouth, he thought, like the maw of some primitive creature about to eat him. Confronted by the sphere, seeing once again the alien, unhuman pattern of the convolutions, he felt his intention dissolve. He was suddenly afraid. He didn't think he could go through with it. "Don't be silly," he told himself. "Harry did it, and Beth did it. They survived." He examined the convolutions as if for reassurance, but there wasn't any reassurance to be obtained. Just curved grooves in the metal, reflecting back the light. "Okay," he thought finally. "I'll do it. I've come this far. I've survived everything so far. I might as well do it. Go ahead and open up." But the sphere did not open. It remained exactly as it was, a gleaming, polished, perfect shape. What was the purpose of the thing? He wished he understood its purpose. He thought of Dr. Stein again. What was Stein's favorite line? "Understanding is a delaying tactic." Stein used to get angry about that. When the graduate students would intellectualize, going on and on about patients and their problems, he would interrupt in annoyance, "Who cares? Who cares whether we understand the psychodynamics in this case? Do you want to understand how to swim? Or do you want to jump in and start swimming? Only people who are afraid of the water want to understand it. Other people jump in and get wet." "Okay," Norman thought, "let's get wet." He turned to face the sphere and thought, "Open up." The sphere did not open. "Open up," he said aloud. The sphere did not open. Of course, he knew that wouldn't work because Ted had tried it for hours. When Harry and Beth went in, they hadn't said anything. They just did something in their minds. He closed his eyes, focused his attention, and thought, open up. He opened his eyes and looked at the sphere. It was still closed. I am ready for you to open up, he thought. I am ready now. Nothing happened. The sphere did not open. Norman hadn't considered the possibility that he would be unable to open the sphere. After all, two others had already done it. How had they managed it? Harry, with his logical brain, had been the first to figure it out. But Harry had only figured it out after he had seen Beth's tape. So Harry had discovered a clue in the tape, an important clue. Beth had also reviewed the tape, watching it again and again, until she finally figured it out, too. Something in the tape. Too bad he didn't have the tape here, Norman thought. But he had seen it often. He could probably reconstruct it, play it back in his mind. How did it go? In his mind, he saw the images. Beth and Tina talking. Beth eating cake. Then Tina had said something about the tapes being stored in the submarine, and Beth said something back. Then Tina had moved away, out of the picture, but she had said, do you think they'll ever get the sphere open? And Beth said, maybe. I don't know. And the sphere had opened at that moment. Why? Do you think they'll ever get the sphere open? Tina had asked. And in response to such a question, Beth must have imagined the sphere open, must have seen an image of the open sphere in her mind. There was a deep, low rumble, a vibration that filled the room. The sphere was open, the door gaping wide and black. That's it, he thought. Visualize it happening, and it happens. Which meant that if he also visualized the sphere door closed, with another deep rumble, the sphere closed. Or open, the sphere opened again. I'd better not press my luck, he said aloud. The door was still open. He peered in the doorway, but saw only deep, undifferentiated blackness. It's now or never, he thought. He stepped inside. The sphere closed behind him. There is darkness. And then, as his eyes adjust, something like fire flies. It is a dancing, luminous foam, millions of points of light swirling around him. What is this, he thinks. All he sees is the foam. There is no structure to it, and apparently no limit. It is a surging ocean, a glistening, multifaceted foam. He feels great beauty and peace. It is restful to be here. He moves his hands, scooping the foam, his movements making it swirl. But then he notices that his hands are becoming transparent, that he can see the sparkling foam through his own flesh. He looks down at his body. His legs, his torso, everything is becoming transparent to the foam. He is part of the foam. The sensation is very pleasant. He grows lighter. Soon he is lifted and floats in the limitless ocean foam. He puts his hands behind his neck and floats. He feels happy. He feels he could stay here forever. He becomes aware of something else in this ocean, some other presence. Anybody here? He says. I am here. He almost jumps, it is so loud, or it seems loud. Then he wonders if he has heard anything at all. Did you speak? No. How are we communicating, he wonders. The way everything communicates with everything else. Which way is that? Why do you ask if you already know the answer? But I don't know the answer. The phone moves him gently, peacefully, but he receives no answer for a time. He wonders if he is alone again. Are you there? Yes. I thought you had gone away. there is nowhere to go. Do you mean you are imprisoned inside this sphere? No. Will you answer a question? Who are you? I am not a who. Are you God? God is a word. I mean, are you a higher being or a higher consciousness? Higher than what? Higher than me, I suppose. How high are you? Pretty low, at least I imagine so. Well then, that's your trouble. Riding in the foam, he is disturbed by the possibility that God is making fun of him. He thinks, are you making a joke? Why do you ask if you already know the answer? Am I talking to God? You are not talking at all. You take what I say very literally. Is this because you are from another planet? No. Are you from another planet? No. Are you from another civilization? No. Where are you from? Why do you ask if you already know the answer? In another time, he thinks, he would be irritated by this repetitive answer. But now he feels no emotions. There are no judgments. He is simply receiving information, a response. He thinks, but this sphere comes from another civilization. Yes. And maybe from another time. Yes. And aren't you a part of this sphere? I am now. So, where are you from? Why do you ask if you already know the answer? The foam gently shifts him, rocking him soothingly. Are you still there? Yes, there is nowhere to go. I am afraid I am not very knowledgeable about religion. I am a psychologist. I deal with how people think. In my training, I never learned much about religion. Oh, I see. Psychology doesn't have much to do with religion. Of course. So you agree? I agree with you. That's reassuring. I don't see why. Who is I? Who indeed? He rocks in the foam, feeling a deep peace despite the difficulties of this conversation. I am troubled, he thinks. Tell me. I am troubled because you sound like Jerry. That is to be expected. But Jerry was really Harry. Yes. So you are Harry too? No, of course not. Who are you? I am not a who. Then why do you sound like Jerry or Harry? Because we spring from the same source. I don't understand. When you look in the mirror, who do you see? I see myself. I see. Isn't that right? It's up to you. I don't understand. What you see is up to you. I already know that. Everybody knows that. That is a psychological truism, a cliché. I see. Are you an alien intelligence? Are you an alien intelligence? I find you difficult to talk to. Will you give me the power? What power? The power you gave to Harry and Beth, the power to make things happen by imagination. Will you give it to me? No. Why not? Because you already have it. I don't feel as if I have it. I know. Then how is it that I have the power? How did you get in here? I imagined the door opening. Yes. Rocking in the foam, waiting for a further response. But there is no response. There is only gentle movement in the foam, a peaceful timelessness, and a drowsy sensation. After a passage of time, he thinks, I am sorry, but I wish you would just explain and stop speaking in riddles. On your planet, you have an animal called a bear. It is a large animal, sometimes larger than you, and it is clever and has ingenuity, and it has a brain as large as yours. But the bear differs from you in one important way. It cannot perform the activity you call imagining. It cannot make mental images of how reality might be. It cannot envision what you call the past and what you call the future. This special ability of imagination is what has made your species as great as it is. Nothing else. It is not your ape nature, not your tool-using nature, not language, or your violence, or your caring for young, or your social groupings. It is none of these things, which are all found in other animals. Your greatness lies in imagination. The ability to imagine is the largest part of what you call intelligence. You think the ability to imagine is merely a useful step on the way to solving a problem or making something happen. But imagining it is what makes it happen. This is the gift of your species, and this is the danger, because you do not choose to control your imaginings. You imagine wonderful things, and you imagine terrible things, and you take no responsibility for the choice. You say you have inside you both the power of good and the power of evil, the angel and the devil. But in truth, you have just one thing inside you, the ability to imagine. I hope you enjoyed this speech, which I plan to give at the next meeting of the American Association of Psychologists and Social Workers, which is meeting in Houston in March. I feel it will be quite well received. What? He thinks, startled. Who did you think you were talking to? God? Who is this? He thinks. You, of course. But you are somebody different from me, separate. You are not me, he thinks. Yes, I am. You imagined me. Tell me more. There is no more. His cheek rested on cold metal. He rolled onto his back and looked at the polished surface of the sphere curving above him. The convolutions of the door had changed again. Norman got to his feet. He felt relaxed and at peace, as if he had been sleeping a long time. He felt as if he had had a wonderful dream. He remembered everything quite clearly. He moved through the ship, back to the flight deck, and then down the hallway with the ultraviolet lights to the room with all the tubes on the wall. The tubes were filled. There was a crewman in each one. Just as he thought, Beth had manifested a single crewman, a solitary woman, as a way of warning them. Now Norman was in charge, and he found the room full. Not bad, he thought. He looked at the room and thought, gone, one at a time. One by one, the crew members in the tubes vanished before his eyes, until they were all gone. Back, one at a time. The crew members popped back in the tubes, materializing on demand. All men. The women were changed into men. All women. They all became women. He had the power. 0200 hours. Norman! Beth's voice over the loudspeakers, hissing through the empty spacecraft. Where are you, Norman? I know you're there somewhere. I can feel you, Norman. Norman was moving through the kitchen, past the empty cans of Coke on the counter, then through the heavy door and into the flight deck. He saw Beth's face on all the console screens, Beth seeming to see him, the image repeated a dozen times. Norman, I know where you've been. You've been inside the sphere, haven't you, Norman? He pressed the consoles with the flat of his hand, trying to turn off the screens. He couldn't do it. The images remained. Norman! Answer me, Norman! He moved past the flight deck, going toward the airlock. It won't do you any good, Norman. I'm in charge now. Do you hear me, Norman? In the airlock, he heard a click as his helmet ring locked. The air from the tanks was cool and dry. He listened to the even sound of his own breathing. Norman! Beth on the intercom in his helmet. Why don't you speak to me, Norman? Are you afraid, Norman? The repetition of his name irritated him. He pressed the buttons to open the airlock. Water began to flood in from the floor, rising swiftly. Oh, there you are, Norman. I see you now. And she began to laugh, a high cackling laugh. Norman turned around, saw the video camera mounted on the robot still inside the airlock. He shoved the camera, spinning it away. That won't do any good, Norman. He was back outside the spacecraft, standing by the airlock. The TVAC explosives, rows of glowing red dots, extended away in erratic lines, like an airplane runway laid out by some demented engineer. Norman? Why don't you answer me, Norman? Beth was unstable, erratic. He could hear it in her voice. He had to deprive her of her weapons, to turn off the explosives if he could. Off, he thought. Let's have the explosives off and disarmed. All the red lights immediately went off. Not bad, he thought, with a burst of pleasure. A moment later, the red lights blinked back on. You can't do it, Norman, Beth said, laughing. Not to me. I can fight you. He knew she was right. They were having an argument, a test of wills, turning the explosives on and off. And the argument couldn't ever be resolved, not that way. He would have to do something more direct. He moved toward the nearest of the TVAC explosives. Up close, the cone was larger than he had thought, 4 feet high, with a red light at the top. I can see you, Norman. I see what you're doing. There was writing on the cone, yellow letters stenciled on the gray surface. Norman bent to read it. His faceplate was slightly fogged, but he could still make out the words. Danger, TVAC explosives. USN construction demolition use only. Default detonate sequence 20-00. Consult manual USN VV-512A. Authorized personnel only. Danger, TVAC explosives. There was still more writing beneath that, but it was smaller, and he couldn't make it out. Norman! What are you doing with my explosives, Norman? Norman didn't answer her. He looked at the wiring. One thin cable ran into the base of the cone, and a second cable ran out. The second cable went along the muddy bottom to the next cone, where there were again just two cables, one in and one out. Get away from there, Norman. You're making me nervous. One cable in and one cable out. Beth had wired the cones together in series, like Christmas tree bulbs. By pulling out a single cable, Norman would disconnect the entire line of explosives. He reached forward and gripped the cable in his gloved hand. Norman! Don't touch that wire, Norman! Take it easy, Beth. His fingers closed around the cable. He felt the soft plastic coating, gripped it tightly. Norman, if you pull that cable, you'll set off the explosives. I swear to you. It'll blow you and me and Harry and everything to hell, Norman! He didn't think it was true. Beth was lying. Beth was out of control, and she was dangerous, and she was lying to him again. He drew his hand back. He felt the tension in the cable. Don't do it, Norman! The cable was now taut in his hand. I'm going to shut you down, Beth. For God's sake, Norman, believe me, will you? You'll kill us all! Still, he hesitated. Could she be telling the truth? Did she know about wiring explosives? He looked at the big gray cone at his feet. reaching up to his waist. What would it feel like if it exploded? Would he feel anything at all? The hell with it, he said aloud. He pulled the cable out of the cone. The shriek of the alarm, ringing inside his helmet, made him jump. There was a small liquid crystal display at the top of his faceplate, blinking rapidly. Emergency! Emergency! Oh, Norman! God damn it! Now you've done it! He barely heard her voice over the alarm. The red cone lights were blinking all down the length of the spacecraft. He braced himself for the explosion. But then, the alarm was interrupted by a deep, resonant male voice that said, "Your attention, please. Your attention, please. All construction personnel clear the blast area immediately. TVAC explosives are now activated. The countdown will begin now. Mark 20 and counting." On the cone, a red display flashed 20-00. Then it began counting backward. 1959, 1958. The same display was repeated on the crystal display at the top of his helmet. It took him a moment to put it together, to understand. Staring at the cone, he read the yellow lettering once again. USN construction demolition use only. Of course, TVAC explosives weren't weapons. They were made for construction and demolition. They had built-in safety timers, a programmed 20-minute delay before they went off, to allow workers to get away. 20 minutes to get away, he thought. That would give him plenty of time. Norman turned and began striding quickly toward DH-7 and the submarine. 0140 hours. He walked evenly, steadily. He felt no strain. His breath came easily. He was comfortable in his suit, all systems working smoothly. He was leaving. "Norman, please!" Now Beth was pleading with him, another erratic shift of mood. Norman ignored her. He continued on toward the submarine. The deep, recorded voice said, "Your attention, please. All Navy personnel clear the blast area. 19 minutes and counting." Norman felt an enormous sense of purposefulness, of power. He had no illusions anymore. He had no questions. He knew what he had to do. He had to save himself. "I don't believe you're doing this, Norman. I don't believe you're abandoning us." "Believe it," he thought. After all, what choice did he have? Beth was out of control and dangerous. It was too late to save her now. In fact, it was crazy to go anywhere near her. Beth was homicidal. She'd already tried to kill him once and had nearly succeeded. And Harry had been drugged for 13 hours. By now he was probably clinically dead, brain dead. There was no reason for Norman to stay. There was nothing for him to do. The sub was close now. He could see the fittings on the yellow exterior. "Norman, please. I need you." "Sorry," he thought. "I'm getting out of here." He moved around beneath the twin propeller screws, the name painted on the curved hull, Deep Star 3. He climbed the footholds, moving up into the dome. "Norman!" Now he was out of contact with the intercom. He was on his own. He opened the hatch, climbed inside the submarine. He unlocked his helmet, pulled it off. "Your attention, please. 18 minutes and counting." Norman sat in the pilot's padded seat, faced the controls. The instruments blinked on, and the screen, directly before him, glowed. "Deep Star 3, command module. Do you require help? Yes, no, cancel." He pressed yes. He waited for the next screen to flash up. It was too bad about Harry and Beth. He was sorry to leave them behind, but they had both, in their own ways, failed to explore their inner selves, thus making them vulnerable to the sphere and its power. It was a classic scientific error, this so-called triumph of rational thought over irrational thought. Scientists refused to acknowledge their irrational side, refused to see it as important. They dealt only with the rational. Everything made sense to a scientist, and if it didn't make sense, it was dismissed as what Einstein called the merely personal. The merely personal, he thought, in a burst of contempt. People killed each other for reasons that were merely personal. Deep Star 3, checklist options. Descend, ascend, secure, shut down, monitor, cancel. Norman pressed, "Ascend." The screen changed to the drawing of the instrument panel with the flashing point. He waited for the next instruction. Yes, he thought, it was true. Scientists refused to deal with the irrational. But the irrational side didn't go away if you refused to deal with it. Irrationality didn't atrophy with disuse. On the contrary, left unattended, the irrational side of man had grown in power and scope. And complaining about it didn't help either. All those scientists whining in the Sunday supplements about man's inherent destructiveness and his propensity for violence, throwing up their hands, that wasn't dealing with the irrational side. That was just a formal admission that they were giving up on it. The screen changed again. Deep Star 3, ascend checklist. 1. Set ballast blowers to on. Proceed to next. Cancel. Norman pushed buttons on the panel, setting the ballast blowers, and waited for the next screen. After all, how did scientists approach their own research? The scientists all agreed, scientific research can't be stopped. If we don't build the bomb, someone else will. But then, pretty soon, the bomb was in the hands of new people, who said, if we don't use the bomb, someone else will. At which point, the scientists said, those other people are terrible people. They're irrational and irresponsible. We scientists are okay, but those other people are a real problem. Yet the truth was that responsibility began with each individual person and the choices he made. Each person had a choice. Well, Norman thought, there was nothing he could do for Harry or Beth any longer. He had to save himself. He heard a deep hum as the generators turned on and the throb of the propellers. The screen flashed. Deep Star 3, pilot instruments activated. Here we go, he thought, resting his hands confidently on the controls. He felt the submarine respond beneath him. Your attention, please. 17 minutes, and counting. Muddy sediment churned up around the canopy as the screws engaged, and then the little submarine slipped out from beneath the dome. It was just like driving a car, he thought. There was nothing to it. He turned in a slow arc, away from DH-7, toward DH-8. He was 20 feet above the bottom, high enough for the screws to clear the mud. There were 17 minutes left. At a maximum ascent rate of 6.6 feet per second, he did the mental calculation quickly, effortlessly, he would reach the surface in 2.5 minutes. There was plenty of time. He moved the submarine close to DH-8. The exterior habitat floodlights were yellow and pale. Power must be dropping. He could see the damage to the cylinders, streams of bubbles rising from the weakened A and B cylinders, the dents in the D, and the gaping hole in E-sill, which was flooded. The habitat was battered and dying. Why had he come so close? He squinted at the portholes, then realized he was hoping to catch sight of Harry and Beth one last time. He wanted to see Harry, unconscious and unresponsive. He wanted to see Beth standing at the window, shaking her fist at him in maniacal rage. He wanted confirmation that he was right to leave them. But he saw only the fading yellow light inside the habitat. He was disappointed. Norman. Yes, Beth. He felt comfortable answering her now. He had his hands on the controls of the submarine, ready to make his ascent. There was nothing she could do to him now. Norman, you really are a son of a bitch. You tried to kill me, Beth. I didn't want to kill you. I had no choice, Norman. Yeah, well, me too. I have no choice. As he spoke, he knew he was right. Better for one person to survive. Better than nothing. You're just going to leave us? That's right, Beth. His hand moved to the ascent rate dial. He set it to 6.6 feet, ready to ascend. You're just going to run away? He heard the contempt in her voice. That's right, Beth. You, the one who kept talking about how we had to stay together down here? Sorry, Beth. You must be very afraid, Norman. I'm not afraid at all. And indeed, he felt strong and confident, setting the controls, preparing for his ascent. He felt better than he had felt for days. Norman, she said, please help us. Please! Her words struck him at some deep level, arousing feelings of caring, of professional confidence, of simple human kindness. For a moment he felt confusion. His strength and conviction weakened. But then he got a grip on himself and shook his head. The strength flew back into his body. "Sorry, Beth. It's too late for that." And he pressed the ascend button, heard the roar as the ballast tanks blew, and Deep Star 3 swayed. The habitat slipped away below him, and he started toward the surface, 1,000 feet above. Black water. No sense of movement except for the readings on the glowing green instrument panel. He began to review the events in his mind as if he were already facing a Navy inquiry. Had he done the right thing, leaving the others behind? Unquestionably, he had. The sphere was an alien object which gave a person the power to manifest his thoughts. Well and good, except that human beings had a split in their brains, a split in their mental processes. It was almost as if men had two brains. The conscious brain could be consciously controlled and presented no problem, but the unconscious brain, wild and abandoned, was dangerous and destructive when its impulses were manifested. The trouble with people like Harry and Beth was that they were literally unbalanced. Their conscious brains were overdeveloped, but they had never bothered to explore their unconscious. That was the difference between Norman and them. As a psychologist, Norman had some acquaintance with his unconscious. It held no surprises for him. That was why Harry and Beth had manifested monsters, but Norman had not. Norman knew his unconscious. No monsters awaited him. No. Wrong. He was startled by the suddenness of the thought, the abruptness of it. Was he really wrong? He considered carefully, and decided once again that he was correct after all. Beth and Harry were at risk from the products of their unconscious, but Norman was not. Norman knew himself. The others did not. The fears unleashed by contact with the new life form are not understood. The most likely consequence of contact is absolute terror. The statements from his own report popped into his head. Why should he think of them now? It had been years since he had written his report. Under circumstances of extreme terror, people make decisions poorly. Yet Norman wasn't afraid. Far from it. He was confident and strong. He had a plan. He was carrying it out. Why should he even think of that report? At the time, he'd agonized over it, thinking of each sentence. Why was it coming to mind now? It troubled him. "Your attention, please. 16 minutes and counting." Norman scanned the gauges before him. He was at 900 feet, rising swiftly. There was no turning back now. Why should he even think of turning back? Why should it enter his mind? As he rose silently through black water, he increasingly felt a kind of split inside himself, an almost schizophrenic internal division. Something was wrong, he sensed. There was something he hadn't considered yet. But what could he have overlooked? Nothing, he decided, because unlike Beth and Harry, I am fully conscious. I am aware of everything that is happening inside me. Except Norman didn't really believe that. Complete awareness might be a philosophical goal, but it was not really attainable. Consciousness was like a pebble that rippled the surface of the unconscious. As consciousness widened, there was still more unconsciousness beyond. There was always more, just beyond reach. Even for a humanistic psychologist. Stein, his old professor. You always have your shadow. What was Norman's shadow side doing now? What was happening in the unconscious, denied parts of his own brain? Nothing. Keep going up. He shifted uneasily in the pilot's chair. He wanted to go to the surface so badly. He felt such conviction. I hate Beth. I hate Harry. I hate worrying about these people, caring for them. I don't want to care anymore. It's not my responsibility. I want to save myself. I hate them. I hate them. He was shocked. Shocked by his own thoughts, the vehemence of them. I must go back, he thought. If I go back, I will die. But some other part of himself was growing stronger with each moment. What Beth had said was true. Norman had been the one who kept saying that they had to stay together, to work together. How could he abandon them now? He couldn't. It was against everything he believed in. Everything that was important and human. He had to go back. I am afraid to go back. At last, he thought, there it is. fear so strong he had denied its existence, fear that had caused him to rationalize abandoning the others. He pressed the controls, halting his ascent. As he started back down, he saw that his hands were shaking.